Okay, so let's remember what we're up to and what we need to do today. Last time, we had a bit of an introduction to euthanasia, and it may not have seemed that way, and I recognize that, because a lot of what I dealt with was certain times that we may have permissibility to take a life, and that was complicated. Now, at the end of class last week, or I remember it was the end, or towards the end, or after the end, somebody asked me a question which I thought was a very fair question. The question was, you know, if a person, let's just say, I don't know what example you want, you know, one of the three things was idolatry. So even if we imagine that Christianity is idolatry, which again is a point which is not 100% clear, when they start putting up, using certain icons, using certain things that they may serve, so it's a problem. But let's just say it is idolatry. And somebody says to a Jew, you know, bow down to that, or I'll kill you. It seems like such a silly reason for a person to give up their life. And the reason I say it seems like a silly reason, you don't believe in it. You know, when I compare that to the other two, when I compare that to perhaps taking somebody else's life, taking somebody's life is, how shall we put it? Just one second. Taking somebody else's life is very permanent and is very damaging. You know, how damaging is very obvious to all of us. But, and for that matter, doing something which is considered to be one of the Gilei Arayot, you know, whether it is sleeping with somebody else who's married or incest, okay, that's something which is traumatic and it's a real thing. But to bow down to a statue, and essentially, who cares? So I accept that point. I accept that question. I think it's a very good question. The only thing that I would ask of you is, what if the person bowing down to that thing, to the icon, to the cross, to whatever it is, the idol, what if that person was the greatest rabbi in the world? Would that be demoralizing to the other Jews? Or essentially what I'm asking you is, are you okay saying, well, the rabbi, that's something else, you know, he should give up his life because it would be demoralizing, but for the average Jew, it wouldn't be? If you were to agree with me, or even see, you don't have to agree with me even, but if you were to see my argument that if this person did it would be demoralizing for other Jews, and therefore it would cause some kind of an attack against Judaism, or perceived attack, or weakening of Judaism, then my response would be that Judaism doesn't necessarily know the difference between rabbis and other people, and all people are considered to be special, and therefore the act of any Jew doing this would be demoralizing. Even though, as I said, off the top of our heads, it's not something in our world that we would necessarily fully understand or fully appreciate, or if we were making up the rules, it's not necessarily one of the things that we would have had added. So, what do we still need to get to? We still need to understand the apparent contradiction in the case of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradyan. What was the apparent contradiction? That he was taken out and he was being executed. His students said to him, Rabbi, what do you see? And he said, I see the letters going up into heaven and only the Torah scrolls being burnt. And they said, why don't you do the same thing? Which means, again, why don't you open up your mouth, take in the flames, take in the smoke, and you'll die quicker, and therefore the soul will survive and just the body will be burnt. And ultimately they're saying is that we believe that a person is a soul and the soul will live on, so what does it make a difference now if you allow your life to end quicker? He then said something which is very dramatic, and it was, let he who gave life take life, but let a person not harm themselves. Now, that dramatic statement was quite important for us because a little bit afterwards, the executioner says to him, Rabbi, if I take away this, the wet wool which was on his chest, which was to cause more pain and slow the process, if I were to take that away and increase the flames, would I have a share in the world to come? And then the rabbi says, yes. So he says, swear to me. He swears to him. And then he does this. And a voice comes out of heaven saying that both Rabbi Hanina ben Tradyan and the executioner have a share in the world to come. But that was quite disturbing, because on the one hand, when he was questioned about this, he says, let he who gave life take life. And then we know we dealt with the other cases with that and so on. But how can he on the one hand say, let he who gave life take life? And on the other hand, he says to the executioner, sure, you can go ahead and do it. So that's what we still need to get back to before we finish today. Okay, let's take a look at a couple of other sources now, which are going to help us get much closer to dealing with real issues of euthanasia as opposed to cases that we've been dealing with till now. First is a Gemara in Ketuvot. And as we'll see, you know, very quickly, that this is going to be much, much closer. Hahu yoma denach nafshe de Rebbe, the day that Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, died, gazru banim tanita, the rabbis declared a fast day. Uvo rachme, they were praying. Now, just to understand the scene completely, they're outside the house, downstairs, praying in, let's say, the garden adjacent to the house. He's inside the house, and he is someplace between life and death. Amre, and they say, Kol man damar nach nafshe de Rebbe, whoever said Rebbe has died, which therefore means that we have to stop praying, means that it's over, yidko becheriv, will be stabbed with his sword because we're not giving up. We're going to keep him in this world. Slika amte de Rebbe le'igra. Rebbe's maid, she goes out and she looks by the window, by the porch, Amrin, she says, and something really quite philosophical. Elyonim vakshim et Rebbe, up above in heaven, they want Rebbe. Again, he's between two worlds. They want him up above. The tachtonim mivakshim et Rebbe. And those down below, literally the rabbis down below praying, they want Rebbe. Yihi ratzon, let it be God's will. Sheyachufu tachtonim et elyonim. Let it be God's will that the powers below defeat the powers above. So the sort of like she perceives a struggle or a tug of war taking place over Rebbe's body and or soul. Kevin de Chazai, when she sees Kama Zimne de Ayala Beta Kise, she sees he apparently had some kind of a stomach cancer or something like that. When she sees how many times he has to go to the bathroom, Vachalat Tfilav, Umanachlo, and it's interesting, even on his deathbed, he's still putting on his tefillin and taking them off each time he needs to relieve himself. Essentially, what she's seeing is that he's in a great deal of pain and he is not getting better. Ukimitztaer, and she sees his pain. Amra, she now flips her prayer around and she says, let it be God's will that the powers above defeat the powers below. And the rabbis won't stop praying. Her perception is, now forget about reality, and maybe it is reality, her perception is that it's their prayers that are keeping him in this world. And that's what she perceives as this struggle, this tug of war. But they don't stop praying. Shakla Kuza, she takes a vase, Shadile mi igra, and she flips it out the window, out of the porch, and it crashes on the ground. Ishtaku mirachme. At that moment, they stopped praying. They were all startled. But noch nafshe de Rebbe. And at that moment, he died. So apparently, she was correct, that it really was their prayers that was keeping him in this world. They wanted to know what the rabbis below wanted to know what was going on. Amulei Rabbanan lebar kapara. They said to a rabbi named Bar Kapara, go and see Elzil Ayin, go take a look what's going on there. And like, why did this vase go flying out the window? Azali goes, Ashkhe denach nafshe. He finds that Rebbe had died. Kare levushe vadri lekri l'achore. He tears his clothing, but he turns over the lapel. Patach v'amar, and he says, Ar elim mutzakim achzu ba'aron kodesh. He says, the angels and the mortals have taken hold of the Aron Kodesh, of the Holy Ark. Nitzchu areilim et hametzukim. But the angels have defeated the mortals. By the way, that phrase, Nitzchu areilim et hametzukim, which is one we may not be all that familiar with, every now and again, if you're in an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood and somebody died, you're going to see that phrase, Nitzchu areilim et hametzukim. The angels defeated the mortals. V'nishba Aron Kodesh, and the Holy Ark has been captured, which means that Rebbe's soul, Rebbe HaKadosh, Rebbeinu HaKadosh, he has been captured. Amr le nafshe, they say, did he die? Now, one of the things was, they said, no one can say that he died. Amr lo atum kamarito va'ana lo kamina. You said it, not me. So, what's really important, and again, this is an Agadah, and I recognize this, but what's important to this story is that people are praying. One of the commentaries here, which is the Shita Mekubetza, says something which is remarkable. He says that we can't pray for a miracle, which means once he's dead, you can't pray for someone to come back. You can't pray for a miracle because it's irrational, and we can't have irrational prayers. But he does say that as long as they don't know that he's dead, then you can still pray for something which is irrational as long as you don't know that it's irrational. So as far as they were concerned, they would not stop praying. They will not let go of their rabbi. They will not let go of their teacher. Again, this is Rabbi Yehuda HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi who's the one who is the author of the Mishnah, the one who combines and collects all of the notes of the Mishnah and publishes it. They don't want to let go. Nonetheless, he was in great pain. And then it all comes down to a woman who we don't even know her name, Amte de Rebbe, Rebbe's maid, who along the way made some really interesting philosophical and practical observations. She's the one who says, you know, take a look, that Rebbe is wanted above and Rebbe is wanted below, and there's this struggle taking place between the various forces. And she's the one who then prays, let it be God's will that the forces below defeat the forces above. But then she sees he's in pain. That's what's important to us. She sees that he is in pain, and then she, A, prays, that's going to be important, prays that the forces above, that God defeats the forces below, as it were, the rabbis, and ignores their prayers. But they keep on praying. And that's the moment that she does something. She takes action. She takes this thing, throws it out of the window, it crashes to the ground, and at that moment they stop praying. And that for us is going to be important, because it is at that moment he dies. So therefore, in their world, and I understand that there's all these elements over here of supernatural elements, if in your perception there is something which is keeping somebody in this world, are you permitted to stop that thing? By the way, along the way, there was another question that emerges from this discussion, and that is, are you allowed to pray for someone to die? She prays for someone to die. Now, I want to deal with both of those issues, the prayer for death on the one hand, and this issue of stopping or preventing something which is keeping somebody alive on the other hand. And the latter is, I hope, obviously, is far more important for us in terms of our discussion. So let's take a look. What I mentioned earlier, the Shita Mekubet said, it's in Source 2, Yitker Becherev, the Ilu have a yadi bebir demait lovi by rachmele, that had they known he was dead, they wouldn't have prayed anymore. You can't pray for someone to come back from the dead. So his impression is, but as long as he's still alive, as long as they think he's alive, those prayers are not impossible, which I think is a very interesting comment. Source number 3 is something which is normally discussed in a different context. We're told all kinds of ways that Rabbi Akiva's students didn't treat one another with respect, so this is one of the examples. Rabbi Chelba Ba'ish, Rabbi Chelba was once sick. Lo Ika de Ka'ati. Don't you know the story about one of the students of Rabbi Akiva, Shechala, who was sick? And no one bothered to come and visit, see how he was. But Nichnas Rabbi Akiva Levakro, and Rabbi Akiva came in himself to visit. There's different versions of this line. One version would read, because Rabbi Akiva himself swept up and cleaned up, you know, person is sick and no strength of getting out of the bed, and the whole situation around him or surrounding him is deteriorating. So it says Rabbi Akiva comes in, opens up the blinds, opens up the window, lets in some fresh air, lets in the sun, cleans up the floor, cleans up the whole place, and then the guy had the will to live again. Omerle, Rabbi Haichetan, he said, Rabbi, you've brought me back to life. Yatzer Rabbi Kiva Darash. Rabbi Kiva went out and taught. Kol mishein mevakir cholim, whoever doesn't visit the sick, ki'il shofich damim. Not visiting the sick is as if you're guilty of murder. Ki ata Ravdimi, Amar, Ravdimi, when he arrived from Eretz Yisrael, he said, kol mevakir tachola, gorm lo sheyichya. Visiting the sick causes someone to live. Kol she'ein mevakir tachola, gorm she'almot. And if you don't visit the sick, you cause them to die. My grandma, what does it mean? If you're going to tell me that whoever visits the sick prays for them to live, because whoever doesn't visit, does that, is that analogous to praying for them to die? Do you mean to say as if you died? Ella, whoever doesn't visit the sick, if you don't visit someone when they're sick, you're not going to know if you should pray for them to live or to die. Now, this whole passage wasn't all that simple. But let me explain what it means and how the commentaries take it and what to do with it. One, let's digress for a moment. What exactly is the mitzvah of visiting the sick? So there's a couple of different elements to them. to it. One, you would say visiting the sick. What do you mean is visiting the sick? So it's actually two different things that were just now added in this text. One, to visit the sick means to go in to see what they need, which means theoretically, if you're aware of somebody's need and you don't actually visit them, that is still part of the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. Somebody is sick and needs some fruits and vegetables to be delivered to their house. And in today's world, that's something which is very easy to do. And you call up and you make a delivery and the food arrives, or you yourself bring it, but you don't visit the sick per se. According to a simple reading of this text and Rabbi Akiva's teaching, that is visiting the sick. But where the Gemara went afterwards was that part of visiting the sick is also praying for them. And that was the part that was unclear, because part of it says, if you don't visit the sick, you're not going to pray for them to live or to die. And it sounded like part of visiting the sick is that you can even pray for them to die. That's the way the Gemara is understood by the Ran. The Ran says that apparently there are times you can pray for someone to die. And he'll give a qualification in a moment, but he has a source. What's the source? The one that we just now saw with Rebbe's maid. Because Rebbe's maid indeed prays for Rebbe to die. So let's take a look at that. No, the reason why we're going here right now is because this is not the same as euthanasia, but it's attitudinal. So the Ran in source number 4 writes, Ein mevakesh l'rachem shalich v'liyamud, nira be'inai, it seems to me, dehachika amar, this is what it means, pa'amim, there are times, shetzarech levakesh rachemim alachola sheyamut, there are times that one can pray or should pray for somebody sick to die, kigon shemitztarech ole b'cholav harbe, v'i efshelo sheyachia. When a person is in great pain, and a person is terminal, that they cannot live. And the proof is, brings it from the case of Amtei de Rebbe, and uses the example of Rebbe's maid. So what is it that the Ran just now taught us? The Ran taught that you're allowed to pray for someone to die. And I just want to comment on this. The Aruch HaShulchan rules in this way. Rav Moshe Feinstein very much hesitates. So I just want to make, he says, you know, only people, you can only pray for someone to die if you're a very special person and you first prayed for them to live. And I don't want to say everything he says because I don't understand it. I'll put it that way. I find it difficult. But I'm not convinced that praying for death is necessarily the best thing. And my suggestion would be as follows. That if somebody is exactly the way the Ran just now described it, they're in pain and they're terminal, I think the prayer that we should say would be a prayer of, God, please have mercy on this person. And God can understand already from your prayer if the mercy then should be mercy of bringing them back to life and giving them health, or if the mercy should be that they should stop their pain and they should die sooner. Which means one of the things that sometimes troubles me with physicians is that they say, oh, this person's going to die. Well, you don't know if they're going to die. All that you know is that in terms of modern medicine, I have no idea how to treat them. Some people who I don't know how to treat get better. Most die. But this idea of the permanence of it, of saying, please let this person die, is something which I think in most cases is an overreaction. By the way, I'm not saying it's not the right reaction, but I say over the reaction, you don't have to have that prayer. I prefer the prayer to say, God, please have mercy on this person. And then God could decide how that mercy should be interpreted. So again, that would be my suggestion over here. But if you would then argue with me and say, but excuse me, the Gemara says there are times that you can pray for someone to die, I have to agree with you. And then goes back to this case of Rebbe's maid. I have to agree with you. That's what it says. And there aren't such cases. So what do we have so far? So far, we have the case of Rebbe's maid, who not only prays for him to die, and that, again, was that Gemara in Nidarim, where we see that it says, no, sometimes you pray for someone to die. But not only does she do that, she did something else. She took a vase and threw it out, and that stopped the people from praying. And again, in their worldview, those prayers had power, and those prayers kept this person alive, and now they stop praying, so therefore, does she have a hand in the death, and is that a thing which is proper to do? So there's actually a very interesting case that was brought up in the Middle Ages. And I'll present it and then let's think about it. I'll give you three possibilities. First, Does anybody here know what the word goses means? Gimel, Vav, Samech, Samech. Goses. Goses is a technical Hebrew word for somebody who is in the process of dying. Goses is not somebody with a terminal illness. A terminal illness is a condition. Goses is a process. Goses would be when a person is taking their final breaths. A goses is compared in the Gemara to a flickering candle, which if you touch the candle, you may extinguish it. So a goses, and not everybody who dies will necessarily ever be a goses, but a goses is something where, again, very technical term. So there is a case, and we could decide now if it is talking about a goses or not. There's a case which just comes up in the Middle Ages in a book which is called the Sefer Chassidim, and the case is as follows. There's a person who is between life and death, takes their last breath, right, takes a breath, and stops breathing, and then the Sefer Chassidim says, outside there's a woodchopper. And at the very moment that they took their breath and they stopped breathing, there is a loud sound like this. And it's the woodchopper. And the woodchopper is chopping a tree. And as soon as the sound comes, the person opens up his eyes and starts to again take these very heavy breaths, and then once again takes what looks like the last breath they're going to take. And in that moment again, there's another loud sound which comes, and then the person again opens their eyes. So I'm going to give you three possibilities now. One possibility is that you can completely ignore him. You know, ignore the woodchopper is not relevant to what's going on inside. Let the woodchopper do what he wants to do, and let the person do inside whatever they do, even though every time the wood chops, there seems to be this correlation and his eyes open up again. Or do you tell him, you know, can you please stop doing what you're doing and let this person die in peace? Or do you say to him, keep on chopping, because every time you chop, you bring this person back to life? And in Judaism, I can say that bringing someone, you know, back to life or preventing somebody from death is something which is incredibly important. So which one of those three possibilities do you find most convincing, intriguing, or do you find one most compelling? One, you just don't get involved. It's not your business. That's an external factor. This guy's chopping, let him chop, and it's not my business what's going on. Second is you tell him to stop chopping because he's bothering this person from dying. Third possibility is you tell him, keep on chopping, because each time you chop, you're keeping this person alive, and we need the chopping to go on because that's keeping a person in this world. So which one of those three choices did you like? For anybody not sure, that was really a question that I just now asked. Silence because there's no thought, or you don't like the question? Yael, you can do it.
I like the
question. Okay. Any thoughts?
I think I would not do anything, maybe.
You say, I can't make a choice over here. This is, I don't want to play God. I don't want to get involved. And let whatever happens, happens. So, this question, I'm going to say this again. This question is not an easy question. It's not a simple question. But let's take a look, because it was discussed hundreds of years ago, and it actually makes its way into the Shulchan Aruch, and that's why it's going to be far more important. So let's take a look. Here, just look at source number 6 first. Hagoses eru k'chay l'chol davar. Ad sheh she'emot. A goses is still alive until they die. And Dalit, for example, Ein matzmim et einav hanogeya bo umaziza reza hu shofech damim. If you touch a goses, you're guilty of murder. Rabbi Meirya Mushlo, he gave it a mashal. He compared it to lener shu mitavtef. It's like a candle which is about to go out. Kevin shenagabo adam yad kibo, which means even touching that kind of candle, you're going to put it out. Okay, so one has to be very careful with the goses. I do want to mention, I don't know, or I'll put it this way, it's far more complex in modern medicine what to do with the goses. For example, somebody who was considered a goses 800 years ago, it could be today we have various ways of treating him. A and maybe bringing them back to life. But let's leave that for a moment. Source number 7 is a Sefer Chassidim. Sefer Chassidim is a book from around 800 years ago, which has lots of superstition and lots of customs, and is not necessarily considered to be a book of law, even though here is a law. Ein gormin la'adam shelo yamut mehira. Now, I want you to notice the double negative, ein and shelo. Ein gormim, you should not be the cause, la'adam, of a person, shelo yamut mehira. Don't cause someone not to die. So if we take away the double negative, he just now said that we shouldn't be doing something which will prevent death. That's very interesting. Because those of us who thought right away that Judaism's perspective is you have to do everything you can to keep somebody alive, over here it said don't do something to prevent death. Kigon, for example, Shahaya Echad Goses. Okay, so now we have that word Goses. Somebody's in the process of dying. V'ya Echad Karov La'oto Bayit Chotev Etzim. And somebody outside the house was chopping wood. And the person cannot rest in peace, cannot die, the soul cannot depart properly because there's noise. So what does he say? And again, this may be the surprise to us. Misirim hachotev misham. You tell the woodchopper, stop chopping. Now that should be really interesting in terms of our discussion of euthanasia, because we just now saw a case that the Sefer Chassidim at least says that you tell the person, stop doing this, let somebody die. Ve'ein misimim melech al shano kadei shelo yamut. And you shouldn't put salt, which is a stimulant, on someone's tongue so that they don't die. The person's, again, the ghost is taking that last breath, but then you start using stimulants to keep them alive. He goes, don't do that. Ve'im goseis va'omer eini yochol lamut ad sheyesamuhu b'makom acher. But if a ghost says, I can't die in this room, you need to take me someplace else, don't touch him. Which means the general principle is, don't touch the ghost. And that's what we saw from the previous source. But the other thing that it said here about the ghost is that you should not be doing something, which means either way, don't touch the ghost. Don't do something to speed up death. But on the other hand, don't do anything in order to prevent death. Now that itself may seem terribly confusing to us. And that's what we need to try to resolve. The Rama in Source 8, Yerodea, Simon Shim Lamed, it starts off HaGoseis HaRuchai L'chol Devar, and this whole thing is things about the Goseis. The Rama then writes, V'yesh Amrim De'in Chotzvim Lo Kever, Afo Pisha Eino Imo B'Payet. Don't start digging the grave. Don't, you know, get ahead of yourself on that. Ad Acher She'yamut, till someone's actually dead. Asur L'chtsov Shum Kever, and then he starts talking about grace. V'yesh Sakana B'Devar, and this is definitely a spiritual thing, not a physical thing. V'chein Asur L'grom L'meid She'yamut Mehera. You also are not allowed to do anything which speeds up death. Kegon Mishu Goseis Zman Aroch V'lo Yecholi Parade. Someone's been a Goseis for a while and can't quite die. Asur L'shameta Kar V'kesem Itachtav. Don't start moving them. So again, just to explain this, he's saying, maybe you think that there's a stimulant there. This stimulant is going to be the feather in the pillow. Maybe you think there's a feather in the pillow which is bothering them, and maybe that's why they didn't die yet. Asur L'shameta Kar V'kesem Itachtav Mikoch She'omrim She'yesh Notzot Miktzat ofot shegomrim ze v'chein lo yezizim mukomo. Don't do anything to the goseis. V'chein asur lasum maftechot beit hakneset tachet urshel kedei sheyipared. So let me just here. I actually have right here the keys, the key to the shul, right over here. In we see that they imagined or they believed that the key to the shul actually had magical abilities. And one of the things that they wanted to do was to take the key to the shul and put it under the person's pillow and say, well, maybe that will help the person let go and die. So again, the simple thing over here was, so far, not to do anything to the goseis, don't touch them, don't move them, and just let the person die in peace. And then it continues and it says, aval, im yesh davar shegoreim ikuv yitziyat hanefesh, if there is something which is preventing death, kigon, for example, sheyesh samuch loto bayit kol dofek, that there is a sound coming from outside the house, kigon chotzei veitzim, for example, like a woodchopper, o sheyesh melech al shano, or somebody put salt on this person's tongue, ve'elum akvim yitziyat hanefesh, and these things are preventing the soul from departing, mutar lasir misham. And over here he uses the word mutar. You're permitted to take this away. The ein bezeh ma'aseh klal. Then he qualifies it because you're not doing anything. Ela shemesira moneya. You're taking away something preventing death. We'll consider this more in a second. Source 9, the Darkei Moshe, who is the Rama, also quotes the Sefer Chassidim. Over here, his language is a little bit stronger. Over here, he says that to do something like this, though to leave something which is preventing death, is prohibited. So now I want to stop and I want to reconsider and to think of the implications of this. First of all, the Sefer Chassidim, now we realize, is cited in the Shulchan Aruch and is therefore authoritative. What did the Sefer Chassidim teach? If something is preventing death, you remove it. You're not allowed to proactively do something that will cause someone to die, but you're allowed to do something which is preventing death. Now, I readily admit that this is a very, very subtle distinction. So, for example, all of us should agree that if you walk into a hospital and somebody is a gosase, but they're having a hard time dying, you can't take a pillow and put it over their mouth so they can't breathe because that will kill them, right? So we should have no illusion about that. That's very clear. You can't do something that will cause the soul to be extinguished. On the other hand, the thing that it did allow was to stop the wood chopper, which is causing some kind of stimulation, which is preventing death. And there the Sefer Achid, either this is allowed, or maybe even it's obligated to do this. So as I'll say it again, this is far more complicated. First of all, what's the source for the Sefer Chassidim? Apparently, the source is going to be Rebbe's maid. Rebbe's maid perceives that the behavior of the rabbis when praying is keeping him in this world. So she takes the vase and throws it to the ground and stops them from keeping in this world, which means the vase together with the prayers becomes very analogous to the woodchopper chopping the tree. So therefore, when I see this teaching of the Sefer Chassidim and I say, oh, is there a source for this? I say, yeah, there's a source for this because this, I'm going to say it again, is pretty similar to what we just now saw with Rebbe's maid. But I'll tell you where the problem is going to reintroduce itself. The problem is going to be with the case that we left dangling from last week. And that is the case of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, where we started today. You know, based upon everything that we just now learned, I want to make a distinction. This execution, what did he do? It said he took the Sefer Torah, wrapped him in the Sefer Torah. He took twigs and lit them on fire. He then took wool, soaked it in water, and put it on his chest. So can anybody here tell me that there may be a distinction between removing the wet wool versus increasing the flames? Do you understand why I would make a distinction between those two things? Removing, meaning the wool itself is not giving life. It's slowing death. The fire is causing death. Which means I just now introduce into this discussion a new concept. And of course the question is going to be applications of this. The concept is that active euthanasia, which I'm now going to define by doing mercy killing, active euthanasia, by doing something which will kill somebody, will be prohibited. But what if I do something which is not going to kill them, but right now is preventing them from dying? Which means, is that the same? And I'm going to go straight to what the real issue is going to be. The issue is going to be, how do we understand what life support does? You know, if you put somebody on life support, is life support giving life, or is life support preventing death? And it's over here that we really have to be careful. One of the things that I've hinted at various times during the year was that the definition of death is not one which is easily found. I mentioned the case to you, and I don't know if I sent any of you this article. I mentioned the case of somebody, this was one of the most frightening things I've ever read. It was somebody who was considered to be dead in California, but still alive in New Jersey. And essentially what the family did is that they snuck the body out of a hospital in California where she was declared dead, and they brought her to New Jersey where she was still considered to be alive, and she lasted another couple of years. And then she eventually died. And they insisted, based upon the California definition, she was not really alive. It was just artificially keeping her alive. Nonetheless, she was a girl from 11, 12 years old, but she ended up reaching puberty. She ended up having a period. She ended up, like, all kinds of things in her body kept on moving forward. And it wasn't just like a 10-year-old was somehow artificially being kept alive. And that was one of the really interesting and frightening things about this case. And the other thing is, along the way, if you read this article, you'll see there's a whole discussion on what brain death is. And brain death is essentially something which was created in order to allow certain types of transplants to take place. Because if you don't put the word death in the legal or the philosophical definition, then how can you cut that part out of the body? Which means, again, if theoretically somebody's alive as long as the heart is beating, so then I can't ever do a heart transplant. So I have to artificially keep it alive. Now, the problem is going to be the difference between low brain activity, which, by the way, sometimes could be temporary low brain activity, versus absolutely zero brain activity. So therefore, if there is what's called brainstem death, where there is absolutely no brain activity whatsoever, but I mechanically keep the heart pumping and the breathing taking place, so therefore I can say this person's not really alive, that this person is really dead at this point, but the heart and the breathing is all taking place artificially. So are those things, and here I'm getting to this very difficult question in terms of halacha, are those things giving life, or are those things preventing death? And now you realize why rabbis may not agree regarding certain things like, quote-unquote, pulling the plug, taking somebody off of a respirator. By taking off of somebody a respirator, what is the respirator doing? So let's go backwards a second. If, God forbid, you have somebody who has a serious heart attack or a stroke, so I'm going to say something which is very obvious and will seem simple and almost doesn't need to be explained. The most important thing for those kinds of cases are the first 24 hours. I mean, obviously, that's why it's so almost silly what I'm saying. If a person doesn't make it the first 24 hours, they're not going to make it. But the goal of medicine is to stabilize the individual. If you get them past the first 24 hours, every moment afterwards, then the chances of long-term survival will be increased. So why would I want to put somebody on a respirator initially? I want to put on a respirator in order to allow stabilization. I want to try to create a situation whereby I could hopefully save the person. So before you ask me, well, what does a respirator do? Well, it may depend upon the case. In some cases, a respirator may be the thing which is facilitating life. In some cases, a respirator may be the thing which is preventing death. So therefore, I need to look at the larger medical situation. And by the way, this is going to touch upon another issue, and that is what's called a DNR. If you don't know what a DNR is, it's one of these three letters you need to learn. A DNR is instructions to a doctor or to a hospital or to an ambulance driver or worker: do not resuscitate. That somebody can say, I don't want the medical community to use excessive and, what other word should I use, unnatural forces in order to keep me artificially alive. Now, everything I've been saying for the last 5 minutes is complicated. One of the most famous cases, I don't recall if I mentioned it in the first semester, was the case of Karen Ann Quinlan. Karen Ann Quinlan was somebody who was declared dead, but she was left on a respirator, and the pro-life people wanted to keep her alive, and there were others who wanted to let her rest in peace. And finally, I think her family, if I'm not mistaken, wanted to let her die because there was no chance of ever recovering. And the whole case went back and forth saying, well, you know, keep her on the respirator, you're giving her life, take her off the respirator because it's not really life. They finally took her off the respirator, and lo and behold, she lived another year afterwards without the respirator. So much for, again, quote-unquote modern medicine, because this was enough, you know, a number of years ago, saying that this person cannot survive without the respirator because they're brain dead. Guess what? You cannot breathe unless there's brain activity. And therefore, they were absolutely convinced that she would die as soon as you took her off the respirator. But I'll say it again. Guess what? They took her off the respirator, and then she survived, at least for a while. Now, did she have quality of life? Absolutely not. Can somebody say, in terms of halacha now, I'm not talking about law. Law, it's certainly. Could somebody say that if there is serious brain damage and lack of functionality, that I don't want to use extraordinary measures in order to be saved in such a situation? Would Judaism say that you're allowed to say such a thing? So I'm going to go back and say this again. We saw some interesting sources today. Again, the case of the Sefer Chassidim and the way cited in the Shulchan Aruch was a case of a goseis, which leads me to a whole other problem. In the time of the Mishnah or the Gemara, if somebody was a goseis, you could not save them. There was nothing to do. It means they're in the process of dying. All that you can do is frustrate death momentarily, or for another moment, or for another moment. Today, we have equipment and we have an ability that if somebody is technically a goseis and is going to take their last breath, we can still save their lives afterwards in a whole bunch of different ways. You can save their lives. There are lung transplants, there are heart transplants, there are all kinds of, there's pacemakers, there's all kinds of things that you can do with a goseis that you can save them. So what does modern medicine do with ancient halacha? It makes it much more complicated. And again, I'm not going to get up and say, well, you know, we saw a braita that said that you can't touch a goseis, therefore let them die. I'm not going to say that, absolutely not. I think that we need to be in touch with what modern medicine can do. But the flip side of that is, are we therefore obligated to do any and everything that we can to keep somebody alive under any and every condition? That I'm not going to go so far to say. And then I think the Sefer Chassidim, and as I said, cited by the Ramah, becomes much more interesting. Which means, let's just say for argument's sake, that somebody is 85 years old, and the person had a stroke, and therefore the brain activity, there was a lack of oxygen going to the brain, and the heart stopped for 10 minutes. And now they use excessive means, I'm using the word excessive right now, and they get a pulse back, and they bring them back, but there's going to be brain damage. So could that person have left, halachically, a DNR saying, no, I don't want to be brought back in a compromised situation where there will be no quality of life, that if you can give me a quality of life, then I'm interested, but if you cannot give me a quality of life, I don't want additional suffering. Can a person say that? So I'm going to say it again. That becomes a much more interesting question, and my sense would be that we don't have to, under any and every circumstance, do any and everything that we can do to keep somebody alive. So therefore, if somebody has terminal cancer, and they say, okay, we can have this kind of surgery, which would be very painful, and we'll give you an extra 6 months, an extra year. And they say, I don't want surgery. I'd rather take medication and deal with pain and take pain, treatment rather than go through surgery. Can a person say that in terms of Jewish law? And I'm saying all of these are implications which come out of that case of the Sefer Chassidim, which really came out of the Gemara, that we're not obligated to do any and everything to give somebody no quality of life. And where do we see that from? So actually, the nameless hero of the story today, and who's that? That's Rebbe's maid. Rebbe's maid said he has no quality of life, and all they're doing is they're not letting the soul depart. They're holding on this world, and she throws this vase down, and they stop praying, and then his soul is released, and he goes up into heaven. And I'll say again, the Sefer Chassidim is essentially following Rebbe's maid, and the Sefer Chassidim makes it into the Shulchan Aruch, and therefore, where we place... Let me say this other way around. Therefore, we understand that we are not obligated to do any and every extraordinary thing to keep somebody alive under any condition, but that doesn't necessarily tell me what do I do in cases, for example, where I'll use the case of putting somebody on a respirator, or for that matter, taking them off a respirator. There are many rabbis who will see that once you're on a respirator, you can't take them off the respirator. They'll say, no, that's allowing them to breathe, and therefore they're alive, and you can't stop someone from breathing. There are other rabbis who will say, no, what are you talking about? It depends upon the larger medical situation. That a respirator is not giving life, it's preventing death, and you could take them off. And I'll say, I can understand exactly where they're coming from over here. And there's also this issue of law. For example, if an ambulance arrives on the scene, they're obligated to try this. Again, this will depend in America which state. In New York State, as far as I understand, if I'm wrong, somebody please correct me. In New York State, as far as I understand, that if somebody, the ambulance comes and somebody is passed out and maybe even technically dead, they're obligated to work on the body for 15 minutes. Now, what are they doing to the body? They're trying to get a pulse back. So functionally, what are they doing? They're beating the chest of somebody who may at this moment be dead. And now, by the way, if that person is 20 years old, and I mentioned yesterday, at least in one of the classes, my son has a roommate who passed away 2 days ago. He was 29 years old. He was a young person, and he had heart problems. He had a pacemaker in, and his heart stopped, and they worked on him for 45 minutes, and you're dealing with a 29-year-old person, so maybe the heart stopped, maybe there's a problem with the pacemaker, maybe you can bring the person back, and then you can, maybe it's a heart transplant, maybe it's a new pacemaker, you put them on thing, and maybe the person's going to live another 50 years. I understand, and I understand that. On the other hand, what do you do if somebody's 80 years old and already has a stroke, already has had other diseases, has Parkinson's disease, has other problems, and now hasn't breathed in 15 minutes, and probably has brain damage as well? So at that point, are you obligated to do everything that you can to keep them alive? And I would say no, you're not obligated. But if you had a DNR, then you say do not do something excessive right now. Person has stopped breathing, they don't want to be resuscitated. So again, this is going to be the point where medical ethics are going to deal with, again, legalities, and we respect people's opinions, but I'm saying the halacha over here, how we interpret the respirator is subject to debate. Now, after having said all that, I want to go back now to Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion, and I want to go back to one more thing. If you remember, 2 weeks ago when I started all of this, I mentioned a case. Remember which case it was? It was not a real case. Shall I remind you? It was this case that was made up by Dr. Don Harper Mills called the Ronald Opus. And again, I'm not going to read through the whole thing right now, but essentially what happened is he jumped out of the window and then a bullet hit him, but the bullet that hit him was actually loaded in a gun by him, shot by somebody else who didn't know that there was a bullet in the gun, and therefore essentially what happened over here is that there was not a homicide, there was a suicide because he had jumped out of the window. But this question, I think, is going to help us focus and figure out what to do with Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. So let's go back a second. In my mind, at least, to say to the executioner to remove the wool, I have no problem. And I'm going to give you again my criteria. The wet wool is not giving life, it's preventing death. In my mind, it's the same thing as the wood chopper. You can argue with me and say, but there's a difference. The wood chopper is outside of the door, outside of the room, outside of the house, is outside in the forest, and this person is inside. I understand the distinction. I don't think it's significant. I think we need to conceptualize, and in both of these cases, the item that we're talking about is not giving life, is preventing death. And if something is not giving life, is preventing death, then there may be a mitzvah to remove it. And therefore, in this case, when, again, think about what happened in that with Chanina ben Tradion. His students say, open your mouth and take in the flames. He says, I can't do that. Then the executioner says, well, what if I remove the wet wool? So that, I think, is perfectly fine, and there's no question. Because it's not giving life, it's preventing death. It's just meant to torture him more. We're not obligated to do something extraordinary in order to give somebody more suffering and more pain that we learned by Rebbe's maid, that we also learned by the woodchopper. So all of that, you know, comes together and all of that makes sense. What's going to be the problem? The problem's going to be when he offers to do something else. I want to increase the flames. Hold it. That's the problem. Because increasing the flames speeds up death. So then I have to ask myself a different question. What crime is the executioner guilty of when he increases the flames? And you're going to say to me, well, he's guilty of murder. And my response to that is, he's already guilty of murder. Which means he already, by taking this person and wrapping him in the Torah and taking the twigs and lighting them up and burning him, has already committed the murder. The person's not quite dead yet. And which is why the Ronald Opus case was actually really interesting to me. Because over there you had two factors. One is the guy jumps out of the window and then he gets shot. Now, by the way, as strange as this may sound, the Gemara already mentions that case. The Gemara already mentions a case, but the Gemara's case is with two different people. What if I take something of value, right? A very expensive vase, right? We'll go back to Rebbe's maid. We take a vase from the Ming Dynasty. It's worth $100 million, and I flip it out the window. And then somebody, as it's falling out the window, hits it with a baseball bat. So who's responsible for it in terms of damages? Is the person who threw it out the window, or is the person who hit it? Answer, like most arguments in the Gemara, it's a machloket. It's an argument between different sources. Because the guy who actually breaks it can say, I broke something of no value. Why was it no value? Because it was destined to crash in another second. So therefore, I broke something valueless. And then I have to ask myself a question. Is the discussion regarding property the same discussion regarding murder? Because let's say somebody falls out of a window and I shoot them, right? So now, again, for argument's sake, not even falls. One person pushes somebody out of the window and they're going from the 10th floor to the, as they're going down, and somebody from the 9th floor, as this case, shoots the person on purpose. So who's guilty of the murder? Can I then say it's the same thing as I broke a broken vase, or vase that, meaning this vase had no value. Why did it have no value? Not because what I can sell it for in by a museum or whatever. No, it had no value because it was falling out of the window. So essentially, in terms of damages, I broke something which was already broken. But do I say the same thing in terms of murder? Do I say that, no, I already killed somebody who was dead? Well, the person may not necessarily have been dead yet. So how can I say that I killed somebody who was dead? So that gets more complicated. But the Gemara discusses this case, which again is the initial approach of the Ronald Opus case, where who's really guilty over here is the person who shot, but then it turned out to be the same person, which is the reason ultimately why this is really interesting, going back to Chanina ben Tradion's executioner. The executioner already set the man on fire. He's going to die any second. So removing the flames is obviously allowed because it's not giving life, it's preventing death. Now, the last question, how does Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion then allow this person to also increase the flames? And what does that teach us in terms of issues of euthanasia? So my answer to that would be, it doesn't teach us anything in terms of euthanasia, because this is a unique case, because it's the same person. Because this person is already guilty of murder, by now increasing the flames, he is legally not doing anything of any consequence, because you can't be guilty of killing the same person twice. If somebody else would have said, what do you think if I increase the flames? Hold it. That then becomes a problem in terms of law. Or when they said to him, why don't you take in the flames, open your mouth, he goes, I can't do that. Why? So I would say that this is a question of technical legalities, that the executioner is the only person who can do this. So if that's the case, then we finally got back to the Ronald Opus case. It solved for us the dilemma in the Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion case. It goes back to teach us something about euthanasia, which I'm going to go, and again, I want to try to conclude, even though I'm being a little bit non-committal in terms of actual applications, because there aren't very severe arguments between people over here. One, passive euthanasia, which I'm defining as removing something which is preventing death, would seem to be allowed. Active euthanasia, which will cause somebody to die directly, that is not allowed. Which means the original sources are you can't touch a ghost face because it's like a flame which is extinguishing. You can't do anything. But if there's something which is preventing death, again, like the prayers in the Talmud case, or like the woodchopper in the Sefer Hasidim case, in those things, those are not giving life. Those are preventing death. And preventing death is something which we're now told is not proper. And therefore, you are not obligated to do any and everything. When I presented the case of the woodchopper, and I said there are three different possibilities. One possibility is tell him keep on chopping. The other is don't be involved. And the third one was tell him to stop chopping. So even though maybe we thought that don't play God, don't get involved was the right answer, Sefer Hasidim says no, that you can't do something. Again, it was that double negative. You can't do something to cause somebody not to die when they're dying. And over here, you can't artificially keep somebody alive when they're not alive. And I'll say it again, exactly what the applications of this principle are going to be is not going to be universally understood by all rabbis. But if somebody says, listen, if somebody's on a respirator, and as far as I understand, that person is already dead, and therefore it's artificially giving life, that would be one way of looking at it. But again, some people will look at a respirator as something which is a little bit more than artificially keeping them alive. It's giving them oxygen, and maybe it is something else. So the actual applications over here, even though the principles are very clear to me, the actual applications are going to be subject to debate. But of course, now we understand, hopefully, all the other cases that we presented along the way.